The John Anik and Kenny Florian Podcast.
Gangsters, what's up, guys?
John Anik, Kenny Florian.
Oh, my God!
Here are your hosts, John Anik and Kenny Florian.
Oh, is it great to be here? Is it great to be here? It's always great to be here. Hope the start of your week is going well. It is Monday, September 24, 2018, episode 172 of the Anik and Florian Podcast. No Ken Flow today, folks. If you're on the video side, you can already see that. We have no Kenny Florian today. He had something more important going on, evidently. I don't know exactly what it is, but you know what? The rest of us are here. Ben Wasorek, the crew, Fox Sports, everybody's here, ready to go. A lot of people on board today to talk about a lot of different things. We'll recap the UFC Sao Paulo show. UFC commentator Jimmy Smith back in the States, just called the fights in Brazil. Also going to get his thoughts on some other things, Khabib Nurmagomedov and Conor McGregor, of course. Also, the devastating reality that hit the MMA world last week with the news that MMA legend Norifumi Kid Yamamoto had passed away. And we'll try to sort of pay proper tribute over the course of the show as best we can. The greatest living American, Brian Stann, turns 38 years old today, so we'll bring him on, wish him a happy birthday, get his thoughts, ultimately a prediction from him too on Khabib Nurmagomedov and Conor McGregor, because that is less than 2 weeks away now. Ray Longo coming up as well, and we'll see which group of people Ray Longo can offend this week. But joining me off the top today, you've seen his work at MMAfighting.com, formerly ESPN.com, The Ringer. Perhaps the most talented sports writer that I have come across in my lifetime. The man in the hat, Chuck Mendenhall, filling in for the flow off the top of the show today. Good day to you, sir. How you doing?
Good, man. Boy, that's some tough shoes to fill, huh? Filling in for Ken Flo.
I'm filling in for Ken Flo, or being perhaps the most talented sports writer that I've ever come across. You hate to tell talented people that they have a gift, right? But I got to think at some point in time you recognize that maybe there was something special about a skill of yours or an ability to sort of put words on paper in a way that maybe average men like me cannot.
Oh, man. Well, I appreciate that, John. Obviously, working with you back in the day at ESPN, that was really where I thought it started, because ESPN gave me a little bit of a platform to open up a little bit, not just do standard coverage, to be more of a columnist during that time. And right. I really felt like it began to flourish during that period.
Yeah, found your voice for sure. I mean, from the time that I could read, I feel like 6 years old. Maybe I was a late reader, but I was reading the Boston Globe and the Herald sports pages cover to cover. And for a while, I thought I wanted to be a sports writer, and I did try to go that route. I think at one point my job was a news sports correspondent was my title. I don't know how much news I did, but yeah, I've said it before on this show. I kept running into writers on your level, so I grabbed a microphone and pivoted at that point. All right, a lot to get to with you, not a ton of time to cover it, so I'll get into it. And let's start, of course, with the biggest fight in UFC history, at least to date. Khabib Nurmagomedov and Conor McGregor, 12 days away. I know you've covered this fight extensively, and you will leading up to Showtime. The presser, of course, was Thursday in New York City. Your column is out there at MMAfighting.com. I will refer to it as needed, but for those that haven't read it, just general thoughts on what transpired in front of us Thursday. At least we got something to chew on now.
Yeah, I mean, it was the first. I mean, it's kind of funny that we went this deep into this fight coming together before we saw these guys actually do this. So that was right. The first thing that was just strange was just watching these two guys on the same stage there. And it was made all the more surreal, obviously, because it was Radio City Music Hall. And the way that the media was seating was facing out toward the actual auditorium. So you're looking at this vacuous area. And it was very, very – it was like a magnificent – it was like being in an empty church. And so it was like, it was just a very surreal setup. It was a crazy first exchange. And it was really interesting to see Conor McGregor have to control and, you know, kind of harness his own energy rather than feeding off of his crowd and project that himself and still stir up that kind of, you know, that kind of presence there. I was pretty impressed with it, but it took about 10 minutes for me to fully set in and be like, okay, now you're in this thing. He's created his own energy.
Right. We could probably spend 15 minutes dissecting every utterance, and we're not going to do that, but we will spend a few minutes more on it. I guess what's most impressive for me is that Conor McGregor, while well-researched in terms of some points that he wants to bring up in a thoughtful way. He really does shoot from the hip. And for a guy who's been out of practice in doing this, you know, he hits that podium and you heard maybe just a little excitability early from Connor, but he settles in and is just so articulate and so pointed with the way he approaches these things that I don't care how good you are, nobody's going to even compete with him, never mind beat him in this type of setting.
No, I agree with you 100%. And it's not just that, too. He knows how to bring comic relief. If the tension gets pretty thick, which it does every time he's in there because of the way he makes it personal, he throws out like an advertisement for the Proper 12, or he, you know, he says something completely funny or starts making noises into the mic, or he just makes some completely digressive thought pop up. And it's a real controlling of the scene and real controlling of attention. And I mean, nobody in UFC has that kind of ability. Even Chael Sonnen back in the day when he was doing it, I felt like he was the best at the time. But this guy's on another level, man. It's fun. It's fun to have what I consider now our Muhammad Ali in terms of the pre-fight talk.
Yeah, I think the comparison's appropriate. You injected the Proper 12 Irish whiskey into the conversation. So I'll go back to it. You have a bottle of this, right?
Look at this right here, John.
Oh. I was hoping it was going to be on the rocks, right? And I knew you had that. So I went to two liquor stores here in the South Florida area today. And I got to show is a red Solo cup. I couldn't find it. I probably should have called first. But I think I have to go into the deep south of Florida to get a bottle of Proper 12. I know I've tested it at this point. How is it?
You know what? I actually have not. I've kept it sealed. I've kept it sealed so far, but I was tempted this weekend. I just never got around to it, man. But I'm going to be cracking into that bad boy at some point this week, I think. Got to do it
so
before
Connor,
I get out to
Vegas. Oh, you got to do it. Yeah, and you can be sure next week when we really preview the hell out of UFC 229, I will have a bottle of Proper 12, and I will be drinking no matter the hour. You describe Khabib at the press conference in your column as mostly bemused. I think that's about as accurate as you can get. Insouciant, I think, at times, and maybe got agitated a little bit late, but I thought for Khabib, just was sort of settling in and letting Conor do his thing and didn't seem too phased really one way or the other, at least for the majority of what we saw transpire.
That's the beauty of it, right? Because this is a guy who's on another level of stoicism. Like, he just has always been very nonplussed in high-stakes situations. He's handled himself. I mean, he has conversations in the cage while he's given a beatdown, which is one of those type of things that's other level poise, you know what I mean? And really kind of cold and unnerving when it comes down to it. And I thought he handled himself just fine. He did get a little riled toward the end, you know, because there was Connor just plucking on every nerve continuously. I felt like he got a little riled up. You heard him raise his voice toward the end. But honestly, man, I think he anticipates everything that's going to happen through this. And I really don't think he's the kind to bend to that kind of pressure. I don't think that a few words are going to affect him. And I think the point I tried to point out in that piece was, it's almost like he's just biding his time. You know, he just wants to get through all the pageantry to the point where they close the cage door, and then he can enact his will on Conor McGregor. And I think that that's the way he carried himself through that whole thing.
Well, and how you put it, you said more to the idea that he gets to do bodily harm to McGregor in the near future was enough to sustain Nurmagomedov and give him a peaceful demeanor, right? Just excited that ultimately he's going to get an opportunity in a controlled setting to do what he thinks he can do against Conor McGregor. Now, pay-per-view naysayers, and some people are projecting north of 2.5 million pay-per-view buys. We can certainly hope for that. But naysayers would say, oh, Khabib Nurmagomedov, you know, doesn't resonate with an American audience, sort of an unknown. Not a household name in the States, right? I will give you that. But 5.8 million on the Instagram followers, right? 26-0 brings people in. I think given the opponent, given some of the backdrop and things that Khabib brings to the table, win or lose, I think this just has the opportunity to be massive for him.
I agree with you 100%. You know, that Dolly incident, too, I think only feeds into it. You know, because the hardcore fans or the people who love MMA are going to tune in no matter what. They're going to pay whatever price they're going to tune in. And that's going to be the whole number of the – I feel like sometimes we get a little bit of a diminished number because not all the hardcores tune in now for every fight. But I think that all of them across the board will be tuned in. And when you bring that extra element, the 2 years away, the undefeated record, the kind of destroyer he's been, never losing a round, and you just start to play with that, I think it will get out into the general consciousness a little bit. And I think that the casuals or whatever you want to call them, the people don't normally tune in, will be tuned in. I hear about this fight constantly from people who obviously don't follow the sport that closely. So just gauging, it's always a crude gauge, but just gauging off of something like that, I think that 2.5 million number, I think that that's probably the bar. I think that that's, it's going to be right in that range, just given the early indications on it.
Yeah. You know, when my 67-year-old mother is talking about the fight, that we got something. MMAfighting.com's Chuck Mendenhall with us here on the Anakin Florian podcast. So what are your expectations for fight week in terms of Khabib Nurmagomedov and how he'll handle all of that? You know, I'm not going to run down his schedule for you, but I can certainly tell you that he hasn't experienced anything close to this magnitude.
No, he hasn't. And that is always a psychological thing that happens during these fight weeks, because, you know, man, we've seen the escalation of Conor McGregor, but I mean, nobody in the UFC has gone through that Mayweather ordeal. Nobody has gone through that kind of pageantry, that kind of stage. Well, he's done that now. Right. He's back. This probably feels like a little bit of a homecoming to him, but the scrutiny is bigger. There's so many more eyes on it. He's going to know, Conor McGregor is going to know exactly what to do through this whole process. You always wonder psychologically how the other side of that, because this is something new. It feels like there's a magnitude. It feels like there's pressure. There's pressure on all of us. There's pressure for me to write well during this thing and to explain it. There's pressure on, you know, everybody to talk about it the right way. There's pressure on everybody. But being the main principal, the guy who's he's the champion, but he feels like the contender going in, psychological interplay there too. It's going to be big, but I think that he's one of those guys. He's got a he's very, very faithful man, obviously. He's faith-driven. He's very principled in his beliefs, and I think he's pretty grounded. And I think he may struggle a little bit through it, but I think once you get to Saturday and he's made weight and everything's going on, that he'll restore himself and he'll be right back to where he wants to be. I believe that he's got the mental fortitude to deal with this whole thing, the whole circus.
I think so, too. Yeah, and I'm excited to see him walk and sort of embrace everything that comes with this opportunity. It's funny when you talk about the pressure on everybody in the MMA world, because I hadn't necessarily thought about it that way, but I will tell you, this is the furthest out that I've ever thought about my pay-per-view open, right? I might even have to ask Zach Candido for a teleprompter this time around, which we don't have, because you really want to nail it, right? And I don't mean so much in terms of not flubbing the delivery, right? But just making sure we say the right thing and contextualize this fight in the right way and the combatants in the right way, because fights like this just don't come around every day.
Oh man, and you followed you're a boxing guy. You followed the way they chronicled the old days. You went back and looked at the magnitude of some of the films, and you know what I mean. Like you hear the call. I mean, all of it gives me goosebumps thinking about it, because the sport is arranged to have things like this happen. It's supposed to have once in a while two momentums colliding at the absolute prime of their careers and coming together, where you really have no clue as to what's going to happen once they latch the cage door. So I think it's it's tough. I wouldn't want to be in your position. It's funny, like you were talking about not wanting to ride against guys like me. I would not want. I wouldn't want to be in your shoes, man, because that's kind of the thing that goes down on the historic record, where everybody will reference it. Not to put any undue pressure on you, but it's everybody's going to remember the call. You know what I mean? That's the way it seems to me, anyway.
Well, yeah, we'll see what we can do. And you know, for us, we always say the anxiety is in the preparation. And because I don't really rehearse or think about what I'm going to say so much, the call sort of just is organic. And there are three of us. And you know, hopefully it goes well. But yeah, it is interesting to think about all the different angles. So the one thing for me as an MMA fan that is hard about a fight like this and a fight like Daniel Cormier, Stipe, Miocic a few weeks ago is that this is a Super Bowl for me, right? So I'm anxious just as a sports fan, and yet I'm the guy that has to sort of articulate these moments. So for you, when they bring the fighters together, the final stare down, are you just sitting there? I mean, you're not doing any live play-by-play. You're just collecting your thoughts and sort of best seat in the house guy observing this, like pretty lucky guy, correct?
You know, back at ESPN, I'd always have to write something very quickly. That was tough, because you had to process and kind of centralize everything and try to do something that would make sense big picture to what just happened. Almost impossible to do.
Yeah.
But, you know, I remember Mark Cram, who wrote about Ollie and the thrill in Manila, and he visited the guys, and he had to turn around his piece very quickly. But he had just enough time to marinate on what he'd seen, and he had just enough time to put the pieces together, and it became one of the greatest pieces of combat, you know, literature I've ever read. So I try to always remember that. Try just to marinate on what you saw. Don't overthink it yet. And then just let, you know, try to absorb everything that's going on, including the perception of what happened, because it's always fun to kind of see what people are thinking happened, and then basically get up and put all that to paper and basically see what you get. I try not to put, just like you do. It's like you do your preparation beforehand. You know everything contextually in the context that led in. You try to put that in the context of how it plays out, and then subconsciously almost you just sleep on it, wake up, and write a piece, and hopefully it comes out okay.
Right. Well, it's good that you're not working on a hard deadline. I mean, I'll never forget trying to bang out a lead for like a high school girls volleyball game. And I'm sitting there for 30 minutes and it's like, bro, you need to bang this out. I mean, this is one singular regular season volleyball game involving people who are not yet 18. And I would just perseverate over it and couldn't get through it. So, yeah, we look forward to seeing what you crank out as usual. Now, do any of these outlets that you work for, and I know you've done some podcasting for The Ringer as well, do any of these folks require you to make a prediction on this fight or not?
Not really. That's kind of funny that you mentioned that. The way they do it in MMA fighting, I think we have one person who does predictions. I don't know why we do it this way, the way it's always been. So I don't really go on the record there. And we haven't traditionally, although I will be covering this event coming up for The Ringer. So there may be... You know, Bill, your guy, they may want me to go on record and say something about it. We'll have to see. But I tell you right now, thinking about it, I'm not sure which way I go. I feel like you've got to kind of see how things play out during fight week. And I always get a feel, you know, as you're in the room with these guys and you, can try to pick up a little bit of the energy exchange and, you know, the demeanor and everything. I like to do that before I make a prediction anyway. So I couldn't even give you a gut feeling right this second, though.
Right. No, and I think we all sort of think about where we might lean, but when your feet are to the fire, which way do you go? And it's hard also to make a prediction, as you mentioned, this far out, right? A lot of folks like the benefit of seeing what happens on weigh-in day, and the betting line is held pretty steady. Khabib Nurmagomedov about minus 170, Conor McGregor plus 140 or so. All right, a couple more things before.
Expect that to swing to McGregor, though?
Absolutely. I mean, I've been telling people on this podcast for weeks, if you want to bet on Conor McGregor, now is the time to do it. And yet the number plus 140 has been sitting out there for 2 weeks. So, Chuck, obviously I do not have much of an impact on the betting line, sadly. No. All right, a couple more things, and one of them is a sad note. Late last week, word coming down that Black Zillions founder Glenn Robinson had passed away after an apparent heart attack. Now, you reported extensively on the dissolution of the Black Zillions and the fallout between Glenn, of course, the team's architect, and Henry Hooft and all of that. So I'd imagine just having recently dived into that this news kind of hit you in a particular way, and really sad to lose Glenn Robinson a few days ago.
Yeah, that was sad news, and it was weird because you immediately start to go back and remember your conversation, because I had a very long conversation, maybe a couple hours, and I was sifting through for the stuff that was essential to the piece. But he was a very nice man, a very very kind soul, and I think that he had a real appreciation for MMA, and I think that that's really why he got into it. And you like to have those figures in there that basically enable other people to do their dream. And I felt like he was one of those guys who provided a livelihood and possibly a lot more to a lot of the guys who found him and found their way to the Black Zillions. That I used to call that gym when it first started rolling. It was almost like an orphanage or something like that, because it was guys who defected from one gym or another and ended up with Glenn Robinson and, in Florida. And it was funny how they were really a tight-knit group. And I felt like everybody at that time when they were running, that they're at their strongest, that he was a true benefactor. I thought he was a big boon for the sport and launched so many careers. So very sad news, man. I know it didn't end quite the way, in terms of the way things went with the Black Zillions down the stretch of time. But ultimately, I think he still had a lot of people who were good friends with him, and you hear it kind of in the outpouring from the people now what he meant to their lives. So he was always good to me. He always answered, you know, yeah. Whenever I tried to get in touch with him, he always was there. He'd always give me little insights into what was going on. So I'll miss him, man. He was one of the good guys in the game, I think.
I think so too, and I think he kind of felt perpetually misunderstood by the masses, and maybe that perception became the reality of the way people perceived him. But yeah, he was a good egg, and it's been nice to see certainly some of his former fighters come out and say some nice things in the wake of his passing. All right, Chuck Mendenhall on Twitter. You can find him at Chuck Mendenhall. How easy is that? No underscore, anything like that. You can see his work on The Ringer, MMAfighting.com. And as you heard there in the tease from Chuck, maybe some more enhanced coverage at TheRinger.com leading up to October 6th and the mega fight between Khabib Nurmagomedov and Conor McGregor. My man, my first choice to lead the show today. Thank you for coming on. I appreciate it sincerely.
Always an honor, John. Thanks, brother.
There he is, my former colleague, the great Chuck Mendenhall. And we will get to Kid Yamamoto, and of course, we just referenced Glenn Robinson there. I remember in 2015, after the Black Zillions beat American Top Team on The Ultimate Fighter, Kamaru Usman winning that final fight, I believe, over Haider Hassan, interviewing Glenn inside the octagon. And this was really the crowning achievement for this man. He had a lot of business success. I believe he founded a tool company that ultimately resulted in some wealth that he parlayed into doing this mixed martial arts thing. But Glenn really started this thing, this MMA team, the Black Zillions, by accident, right? That there were some defections from American Top Team, and he was bringing guys together, and eventually had big names like Eddie Alvarez and Rashad Evans. Vitor Belfort was one of the first guys to sort of represent the Black Zillions. Of course, Anthony Rumble Johnson. And he was a unifying force for these guys for a while. Then there was obviously a fallout that we're not going to dig too deep into, but really sad news. And Glenn was just so happy for Kamaru at that time, and was just so happy to have sort of gotten over that ATT hump, even though at times things didn't go well for them during that season. That was huge for Glenn Robinson. And his daughter, Sam, I know, has been out there on social media, and we're thinking about her and the rest of the family as they mourn the loss of the great Glenn Robinson. All right, a lot more to get to today. Let us bring on the great Ray Longo.
It's now time for the Ray Longo Minute.
I want you to punch a hole in his fucking chest. That's what I want.
The Ray Longo Minute. Starring Ray Longo. The John Anik and Kenny Florian Podcast.
You know, I never want to start with you on a somber note, but as we do get older, I think one of the harsher realities is that a lot of people our age tend to pass away for one reason or another. And I know I've experienced it a lot in my personal life and for MMA in the past week. Ray, Glenn Robinson, who we were just talking about, and of course, Kid Yamamoto, the Japanese mixed martial arts legend. I don't know if you had any dealings with Glenn or with Kid in the past, but, you know, felt like a couple of body blows over the last week since we were last on the air.
Yeah, no, death is never a good thing. And man, I don't know about your age. I think my age, people are dropping. Let's not get carried away, John. You're still in the prime of your life. You know, I'm in the seventh inning. It's not looking good. But no, I tell you, Kid Yamamoto, man. I mean, just too young to go. That's the first thing. That one actually hit harder because I just when people are young, that really bothers me. You know, I'm going through it with my mom now, but she's had a really good full life and she's at peace with everything, man. She's really made me see how, you know, there's some grace in dying. She's just ready to, you know, to check out, and she's, you know, still having a great time. Her mind is good. Her body's bad. I don't want to make it about my mother, but I'm saying I try to talk to her every day. I go over and see her, and she's really, I mean, it is what it is, man. It's definitely a different look for me to see that. But, you know, I didn't know Glenn Robinson, but again, he wasn't that old either. And that kind of stinks, man. It's just, you know, because you do leave behind, you know, kids that are younger and sometimes don't have they're not have the maturity to deal with it. And I just hope it doesn't affect everybody and they recognize it is a part of life and just to move on and live in their honor and do the right thing.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm glad you sort of brought your mother up because that's very relatable to this audience that swears by you. Although I know you've come under attack recently for some of your comments. I love how you're just not afraid to let it rip, man, you know, and stay true to who you are. You miss one of the most epic NFL Sundays of all time, but I digress. In terms of Khabib Nurmagomedov and Conor McGregor, and we're going to spend probably the entire Ray Longo minute next week on this fight and get your final prediction, but do you feel like people are talking about this fight, that when you're going out and pumping gas, people are asking you about this fight? To what extent has this fight resonated with sort of the casual American masses leading up to October 6th, at least from your standpoint?
I mean, from my standpoint, the answer is no. I mean, it's not. Okay. I mean, when McGregor fought Mayweather, there was way more, you know, what do you think's going to happen from the casual fan. I mean, I think anybody okay. who's into MMA is definitely buying this fight. I don't know. I'm not feeling it, but I could be perfectly wrong. I'm sure the fight's going to do big numbers, but I'm not hearing it like I've heard other fights. Definitely yeah. not. But, I had a crazy couple of weeks, so I haven't really been around too much either.
Sure. No, I think that's fair. Did you watch any of that press conference?
I saw about three quarters of it, man. I thought it was just fucking bonkers, you know. But I got to tell you, the guy, there was a stroke of genius in there, because I got to tell you, I like Khabib. I think the guy's a stand-up dude. I think he shoots from the hip. Guys, type of guys that I really like. Always enjoy seeing him. I'm not saying I know him well, but always nice to say hello to, and I feel his sincerity there, and he's a good dude. And man, did McGregor. I think Conor knew that he couldn't get under this guy's skin for the fight. So what does he do? He takes a good guy, and he attacks viciously the people he's surrounded by. Like, I mean, he came in prepared. I mean, the biggest loser in this thing is that poor Ali. I don't even want to say poor, but I know Ali. I found out things about him I didn't even know, and I know the guy. So I think he comes out. I mean, he got slaughtered in this thing because, you know, I don't think anybody likes a snitch, you know. And this guy put everything out there. And then the thing with his son, I didn't even know anything, you know. So he attacks the credibility of the people he's around, which could create some doubt as to, you know, guilt by association type of shit that I don't buy into. But, man, did he come prepared with some shit with even all the oligarchs and all of the other crap. And crazy, crazy that he did his homework. So he's not stupid. You know what I mean? Whether it was a good tactic or a bad tactic, he's not going to get sued for libel. You know what I mean? He's not going to get sued for defamation of character or whatever, you know, whatever would be the legal recourse on that. I guarantee you. So crazy, crazy, crazy. I don't know what effect they'll have on the fight, but man, it was bonkers, John.
Oh, he's good, man. You know, he parlays that preparation into performance too, right? I mean, he has all his cards there, and the way he uses them and seamlessly works everything in, he is one of a kind, man, and we're certainly lucky to have him. But that gives me a little indicator, the fact that you sat down and watched 45 minutes of a press conference. You know, Ray Longo's got a lot of irons in the fire. You got a lot of things going on. The fact that you sat down and gave that a half an hour of your time tells me a little something leading up to October 6th. All right, I have an opportunity.
Wait, hold on, but I don't want to rain on that comment, John, but I was driving to Atlantic City for a fight, so I was in the car, so that's what I listened to. Would I have listened to it otherwise? Probably, but I mean, it was just like, let's get something to do. It's a 3-hour ride, so, you know, whatever. Right. But you're right, though. Anyway, right. I got skin in the game either way, because Al fought Khabib, and, you know, I think this is an interesting fight. Let's see, you know, he brought up Alan A. You beat a real estate agent, you know, which I thought was hysterical, you know what I mean? But now he's got to back it up. You know, he made the comments. Let's see if he could do better than Al. I say unequivocally no.
Yeah, well, I think we know which way you're going next week. But, yeah, I would imagine there's heightened interest for you in this fight because of what Al was able to accomplish in those 25 minutes against Khabib most recently in April. So, all right, we'll get a prediction from you next week. Also, an opportunity for you to win $500. You got to give me your answer next week, okay? $500. See, I don't know how long this Anakin Florian podcast is going to be around, so we're raising the stakes, okay?
Five big ones.
If you can correctly predict Al Iaquinta's next opponent by the end of next week's show, $500.
I mean, okay? I already have the answer to that, but I'll see if I can say it next week. But
Because the reason I bring it up is because you said on the show last week that Al, after watching Aljo and some others, was itching to get back in there, and That is very encouraging news on Ally Quinta that at least maybe a verbal agreement might even be in place.
Well, this is like a poker game. You're buying that I have a straight flush or I have a good hand. I could be bluffing right now.
That's right.
Am I bluffing or am I not bluffing?
Let's see if you can get clearance by next Monday.
Exactly.
And then an opportunity to win another $500 if you can get Khabib Connor correctly. So big opportunities.
I might have to cut Ally Quinta in on the profits.
Right. I think he could do better selling houses. All right, my man, thank you for the time. We will talk to you extendedly next Monday about the big one, man. Thank you.
Very good. All right, John. Take it easy, buddy.
There he is, the great Ray Longo with us every week here on the Anik and Florian podcast. Speaking of which, support for the Anik and Florian podcast comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, America's premier home purchase lender. Let's talk about buying a home. It can be one of the most important purchases you'll ever make. But today's fluctuating interest rates can leave you with unexpected higher payments, which can turn a great experience into an anxious one. That's why Quicken Loans created their exclusive power buying process. Here's how it works. They check your income, assets, and credit to give you a verified approval. This gives you the strength of a cash buyer, making your offer more attractive to sellers. Once verified, you qualify for their exclusive rate shield approval. They'll lock your interest rate for up to 90 days while you shop for your new home. Then once you've found the one, if rates have gone up, your rate stays the same. But if rates have gone down, you get to keep that new lower rate. So either way you win, it's the kind of thinking you'd expect from America's largest mortgage lender. So to get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/ANIK, rocketmortgage.com/ANIK. Rate shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states and MLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030. All right, back out to the guest line now, and joining us, a dear friend of mine. We're happy to have him. Pretty fine analyst, I might add, as well. Just off the boat back from Brazil as he continues his globetrotting in his first year as a UFC commentator, the great Jimmy Smith, now joins me live from the great state of California. We got video! My man, welcome home. It's good to see you.
How you doing, my man? The great state, man. It's a great introduction, I got to say. I thought I was fine, but to hear you say it, man, is awesome.
Yeah, fine. Probably not a strong enough adjective. Nice work, man. So did you hit that? Did you just get back this morning or last night? How'd the travel go?
1 a.m. One this morning I got back. So, yeah, 2 7-hour flights. So, yeah, man, today's going to be a lot of resting.
All right. Well, I appreciate you burning it at all ends and waking up early for us. As you know, I've been to Brazil for more than 20 live UFC events. I know you're starting to dip your toes in the water. I know you've been there in the past, obviously, in your mixed martial arts training and where your life has taken you. But overall assessment of Sao Paulo and how things went for you over the weekend.
It was awesome, man. It was great. Fans were into it. Everybody was really excited. People on the street were really jazzed about it. And the Brazilians did well. I mean, the local guys did well, and the crowd had a lot to cheer about. Of course, you know, Little Nog got an incredible ovation. Talos Leitas going out the way he did on a win over Hector Lombard. So it was a lot of the emotional stuff that the fans were into. That's what they came to see, man, and it worked out great. It was fantastic.
So a lot of different things I want to get to with you, and I think sometimes in these UFC main events, the storyline sometimes becomes the guy who didn't win, and there are a lot of angles to attack Eric Anders accepting this fight and the ramifications of that, but can we talk about Thiago Santos for a second and the body of work that he's put together over the last 2 years? He's 1-6-7, go-to guy for the UFC, you know, made weight another time that we're not even talking about as a backup opponent. I just think the world of this guy, and Eric Anders is a tough out, and I thought Maheta, in a showcase performance for him, really put it to him.
And he really did, and it's not just what he's done in terms of opponents and the runs and how busy he's been over the last couple of years. Man, he has exciting fights. The guy's just not capable of having a fight that isn't exciting. Great at medium range. Right. He switches stances a lot. He throws a lot of power shots. So it's everything both a seasoned fan of the UFC and a newcomer wants to see is that, you know, this monster slinging bombs and trying to take guys out. I mean, everybody loves it. Everybody understands it. And I think what they did a great job with for the Sao Paulo show was focusing on his community work, stuff like that, working with kids. I mean, he's an easy guy to like. He's an easy guy to get behind. So all the way around, he's fantastic.
Yeah, don't let the Maheta tattoo fool you. There's really a nice guy in there. You know? So in terms of Eric Anders, and I know some people are maybe sick of us talking about the college football accolades and the 2009 national championship with Alabama, but this guy's a fighter's fighter, and he may not realize a UFC championship, but I would imagine you, as a former MMA fighter yourself, have a lot of respect for everything that the last 8 to 10 days held for Eric Anders.
100%. I mean, he came in a fight he didn't have to take. He didn't need it. And it's at a different weight class, 205, going into hostile territory. And last minute, and he went out there and did it. The biggest myth, or the biggest lie, however you want to put it, in mixed martial arts is, well, I'm always in shape. You're not always in fight shape. There's a big difference. It's just like the NFL, right. Just like the NBA. They're designed to peak your workout a certain time for a certain day for a certain guy. And he didn't have that camp. And I think in this fight, it showed a little bit. Because at the end, you know, he was just out of gas at the end, exhausted. And against a guy like Santos, who's going to make you work so hard, he's not going to give you any breaks. He's not going to let you implement his game. He got a couple takedowns, couldn't hold him down. It's a guy you need a lot of gas to take on. And I think in the end, he really didn't have it. But, you know, as we said, Santos is a tough out for anybody. And Anders did the best he could under the circumstances. And he was very candid about this being a stop at 205. This isn't my natural weight class. I don't plan to stay here. I don't plan to put my flag here. So he went into a difficult situation with a nothing-to-lose attitude. I thought put on a great fight. And down at 185, I think that's where he really belongs. And he can do a lot of damage at 185.
UFC commentator Jimmy Smith with us here on the Anakin Florian podcast. You mentioned sort of a nothing-to-lose attitude. And I think that is the rub for a lot of people when it comes to Eric Anders. Did he actually have nothing to lose? You know, when he took that fight with Lyoto Machida in Belang, an exciting opportunity for him, but some suggested at 11-0 or so at the time that maybe he was biting off more than he could chew. Some managers would have pause throwing a guy into Sao Paulo up a division against Thiago Santos in terms of career trajectory. And I'm not trying to put you on the spot, you know, to throw his manager Jason House under the bus, because he has a fighter. I know you don't give a shit about that, but he has a fighter in Eric Anders who trains, you know, to be ready 45 weeks a year and is going to put himself out there for the next one of these. So as manager, I mean, do you have an obligation to try to get a guy on a championship trajectory or to just take each guy on a case-by-case basis?
Here's one of the things in my personal fight trajectory, you know, for any fighter, I think it's important to get, if not a loss, that really challenging fight in your first 10 or 15 fights. I don't think you want to go people who have gotten over like 10-0, 15-0 in the big show, they talk about the pressure of being undefeated and not knowing how to deal with a loss and the ability to come back. You have to kind of let your guy know you're going to have tough opportunities. You have to roll the dice. It might not work out your way. You get back on the horse, you get back in the gym, you get there and win. It's not, you know, it's not the end of the world losing a tough fight to Lyoto Machida by decision in Brazil. It's the kind of thing you just move past. And if your guy can't move past that, he doesn't deserve to be in the championship conversation. He doesn't deserve to be amongst the elite. If you can't come back from a loss and learn from it, you're in the wrong sport. So there are other times you talk about, you know, management and getting your guy ready in an era of in the UFC that's become kind of a super fight era where you wait for that one big opportunity to make $10 million. The fighters that want to stay busy and want to keep fighting and want to keep learning, I think, are becoming appreciated by the fans. He's not waiting around for that one opportunity to fight that one guy that might get me in line for a title shot. He's fighting anybody in front of him, and I think fans appreciate that kind of mentality in today's day and era.
No, I think it's beautifully put, and I think the promoter appreciates it as well. And Jessica Andrade, Israel Adesanya, some other names I would inject into that mix of fighters that always stay ready. And, you know, Adesanya could have avoided a guy like Derek Brunson. He wants to take on all comers, you know. Let me go through the top 10 and try to get there on my own. All right, a few other things on Brazil. I don't want to spend too much time on Sao Paulo, but Hannon Barão, it's crazy how the narrative has changed for this guy. And we could talk about a lot of fighters. You know, Jake Ellenberger most recently, right, at 1.29-6, retires 31-15, right? Rashad Evans, the whole narrative on a career can change with how you go out. Hannon Barão at 1.32-1, now 34-7, missed weight famously this weekend on the wrong end of a split decision here against Andre Yule. You were there on the ground in Sao Paulo. Rough fight week for the Baron.
Yeah, I mean, there are two signs when, and I hate to say this, but I have to. When a fighter is done, there are generally two signs. Number one is they don't have a chin anymore. They can't take the shot. They take punches that would not have even stopped them, you know, wouldn't have even given them pause in the beginning of their career, and they get rocked and hurt by those punches. The second one, which is a little more subtle and in many ways a little more dangerous, they can't pull the trigger. And I saw a guy in Hendon Burrell who couldn't pull the trigger, who hadn't put him in front of him, hands down, obviously working the outside, a fast, athletic guy, but this is a guy who in his prime never hesitated. He was like a tiger shark, man. He saw vulnerability and he just went right after you. And that inability to kind of get his offense going, that's a sign of a fighter whose confidence isn't there, whose timing isn't there. You know, probably the most famous instance is Pacquiao De La Hoya, and De La Hoya didn't throw any punches. He was just standing there. And that looked like Hendon Burrell. It's kind of deer in the headlights. The success he had was on top with his jiu-jitsu, which, you know, he's always going to be good at that. But when it came to the stand-up, that guy who just ripped the heads off opponents in his prime was not there. And that was the disappointing part. Is, you know, people talk about the Evan Dunham fight, and dude, the dude went out on a shield, you know, took a knee to the ribs, and that was it. Hendon Burrell got caught looking. He struck out, not swinging. And right, that's a tough thing to watch from a guy who's as good as Hendon Burrell.
Right, and that's bizarro Burrell. I mean, that just flies in the face of everything that he was in his prime. All right, last thing, because you are a Carlson Gracie, I believe, fourth-degree Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt. Is that accurate? Did I get that right?
I'm sorry, say it one more time.
I hope I got that right. Carlson Gracie, fourth-degree Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt. Is that accurate?
What, me?
Yes.
Just a black belt,
so
man.
Okay, all right. I didn't know how many degrees. Sorry. So the Carlson Gracie Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, Jimmy Smith,
my instructor, yeah,
just witnessed Charles Oliveira record his 11th submission in the UFC. And we have watched this guy grow up, made his UFC debut. I think he was 20 years old. I don't know if I'm asking you to put into context what he has done, but when you talk about the all-time great submission guys in the UFC, this is a guy who's going to be firmly in that convo.
Has to be there 100%. And what I love about this performance is you know, I said it on air, is that he's so talented and so good, but he's had trouble stringing together performances in a row. Well, he'll look fantastic in one and then have a setback in another. And the amazing thing about that fight was he was so consistent. There were problems with him. You know, I thought Iago's fought a great fight on the feet, nice sharp combinations. Oliveira never panicked. He never went for any takedowns that weren't there. He never made any mistakes trying to get into the ground. He never threw any big punches to kind of let Yalos land that knockout shot. He stayed composed long enough to get the job done. And I think that's even more impressive than the finish. I mean, it's funny. I was talking to his Yalos' coaches, were Kenny Johnson and Jiva Santana, one great wrestler, one great jiu-jitsu guy. And I was talking to them in the cage as we're standing there, and Kenny goes, man, Oliveira takes your back, it's done. I'm like, yeah, nobody gets out of that. So the finish was great, but it was more the fact that he stayed so composed, waiting for that takedown, didn't make the kind of mistake we've seen him make and you've seen him make in other fights where he seems to have it, you know, he seems to have it done. I mean, I thought he had Paul Felder three or four times.
Right.
Paul Felder
right.
came back and beat him. He didn't make those kind of mental mistakes. So when you take his talent and add a little bit more consistency and octagon IQ, that dude's hard to beat for anybody.
Yeah. Well, it was fun to watch you from here in South Florida. You did a great job on that show. I know you did it somewhat with a heavy heart. I saw your Instagram post after the passing of Kid Yamamoto, and I know the MMA historian in you took this one pretty hard, man. You know, I remember staying up late, obviously, to watch this guy in his prime when I was just getting into mixed martial arts, and this is a guy that really made an impact on a lot of people. There are a lot of highlights that you can reference, but just a guy who was must-see television really every step of the way in his fighting prime, and a huge loss for the MMA world.
It almost feels like the hard part about this is you know, the people who didn't appreciate the sport maybe 5, 6, 10 years ago, he's almost the end of an era in a sense. Like, he was so much a part of Japanese MMA and so much a pioneer in a weight class. It's all, you know, I don't want to say taken for granted, but it is almost like, oh yeah, 145, 55. But there was a time when that weight class didn't exist in the United States, and it was overlooked in the United States, in my opinion. And Kid Yamamoto was kind of the flag bearer of that division when Japanese MMA was really outstanding and really fun to watch. And the death of Kid Yamamoto, as hard as his personal and what a great guy he was, and father and everything. It's also almost like the end of an era in where the Japanese ran that weight class, and you had to go to Japan and really fight the best in a lot of weight classes. And he was a symbol of that. And to lose that really, really sucks as an old school fan, personally.
And it seemed like maybe he was diagnosed with cancer in 2016, but then sort of announced it to the world in August. And then, his demise came shortly thereafter. But I thought you tributed him nicely, man, as only you could do. And, I don't have to say hopefully. His is certainly a legacy that will live on. All right, I'll let you go on this. Pittsburgh Steelers Monday Night Football. It's September 24th. And the AFC, I don't want to say the favorites, but one of the AFC favorites going in has yet to get a win. I think you and I need to bet on this tonight. It's a pick 'em game, essentially, Tampa Bay and Pittsburgh. Would you like to put something on the line here, my friend?
All right. Well, okay. Let's, I'm probably going out. Are you in Vegas? You're in Vegas for the big fight. You're staying out there till Sunday, yeah?
Yep.
Are you staying out till Sunday?
Yes.
All right, how about meal of your choice on Sunday in Vegas, buddy? What do you say?
Let's do it. Let's do it. Go Buccaneers. Right. And if you don't know, Jimmy Smith has a dog named Steeler. So even though this is a lifelong Yeah, he's a lifelong Californian, but he's a Pittsburgh Steelers fan, and we love him for
Lakers,
it. Baby. Hey.
Lakers, right?
Yeah, Lake Show. Right there. That's a good shirt for you. Hey, sorry we didn't have time to get too deep into Khabib and Conor. We'll talk to you on the other side of that fight. Sincerely appreciate your time, my man. Great stuff in Sao Paulo, and I will see you October 6th, if not sooner, my friend.
Can't wait to see you there, buddy.
All right, there he is, UFC commentator Jimmy Smith with us here on the Anakin Florian podcast, and really wanted to actually get his expectations for Tony Ferguson's return as well, because I think one guy that is going to be shortchanged leading up to October 6th is El Kukui, who returns against Anthony Showtime Pettis in the co-main event against UFC 229, but that is just a huge fight, and it's shaping up as one of the biggest nights, if not the biggest night in UFC history, and I'm excited to be in the building. You know, it's fights like this that really get the blood boiling. So we will see how it goes for Conor McGregor, for Khabib Nurmagomedov, all of that. Ken Flo back next week, and we'll get a prediction from him as well. Back out to the guest line now. It is time to take a stand.
It's now time to take a stand with the All-American Brian Stand. On the Anakin Florian podcast.
And joining us on what is his 38th birthday, the greatest living American, Brian Stan. Happy birthday, my man. You don't strike me as a guy who loves birthdays, but we wish you a very happy 38th.
Yeah, I appreciate it, buddy. Yeah, I'll be, I don't remember the last time I celebrated one. but, you know, I should actually start. Maybe for 2 years, celebrate them before I hit the big 4-0 and then I officially become old, I guess.
It's true, because I just turned 40, and I hate birthdays to begin with, right? And 40 was a tough one, man. Like, there was nothing easy about it. You really feel old, and I appreciate you not mincing your words there and telling me how old I am. You also don't strike me as a guy who would respond too well to a surprise party, like if all of a sudden there was a surprise party tonight. So hopefully nobody has one in the works for you.
Yeah, well, I could tell you, there's no way it hasn't been the works for me. I'm going home to another hour. So that won't be
part of the impetus. Part of the impetus for getting you on today was to talk about Khabib and Conor. It's also, of course, your birthday, but it has been just over a year since you called your last UFC fight. So I just want to start there. I'm sure at times you're too busy to miss it, but at other times, maybe when you're sitting around watching a fight, you sort of wish you were, you know, still in the game.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, it's, there's been conversations here or there. Could I fit it in? Could I do this? Could I do that? It's really tough. You know, my current role, I am extremely busy. But, man, you can't help but miss a job like that. I mean, there's no doubt. I think everybody around me, everybody who heard me call fights knew it, that I absolutely loved it. You know, at the end of the day, it was pulling me away from my family. I was traveling a little too much. And, the switch to a new job really didn't matter in that regard. But looking back on it now, you never want to close the door completely. You know, I'm only 38. You never know what could happen. And maybe 4 or 5 years from now, I'd like to go back to doing some television. I definitely miss it. Love doing the job. And really, of course, you know, miss working with you. You and I had, you know, an awesome chemistry. We had a lot of fun exploring these different countries we went to. We made a lot of close friends with these fighters and coaches. And so It was a great environment, man. I had a good time. It was like family. When I left that role, it was like leaving a piece of family, man. That was tough.
Yeah, No, it is. And I know you called one by one a lot of members of the staff, and I know they appreciated that. And a show doesn't go by where someone isn't asking me about you, so there's no denying the impact that you made. How close are you to the sport in terms of following the day-to-day headlines? Like when this whole Jackson Wink MMA thing starts to bubble and Donald Cerrone and Diego Sanchez are getting into it and the Mike Winklejohn backdrop, I mean, I'd imagine a headline like that at least still crosses the COO's desk.
I would tell you that I tend to, on a lunch break or at night, I will look at the major websites every day. I mean, you can't help, like, that's still a big part of me, right? I mean, I'm forever going to be a martial artist. And I'm a huge Eagles fan, but I'm a huge mixed martial arts fan. And so when I have the time and I'm trying to consume that and watch those fights, so it definitely hit me. I think that that was a situation that was brewing for a long time. You know, the minute that BMF Ranch opened up, and even before then, when Cowboy and Leonard Garcia started making money on opening up their home to other fighters, it was a great business idea. Cowboy bought a bus, and he would bus in all these fighters who paid a certain amount of money to stay at his place every month, and he would give Greg Jackson a piece of it. I mean, it was a great value proposition for him. He made a ton of money doing it, and that really led to what was the creation of the BMF Ranch, and there was going to be some divide there, and I see both sides of it. One thing I would tell you is that coaching fighters is really tough to be profitable. Because when they lose, it's always somebody else's fault. So they leave the gym. They don't pay very well, or they don't pay on time. You know, you got to hassle them to pay the money that they owe you for the percentage of their purse. So it was really tricky. And I would say that Greg Jackson is a sweet person. He's a very good coach. He's a great guy. And one of the things he's not good at is telling fighters, like, hey, you owe me money. Because it was never important to him. So, you know, when it came to actually running a profitable gym, that wasn't his strength. His strength was coaching fighters. So Wink watched that and said, look, we're going to move it to my building. I've got bills to pay. So I kind of understand both sides. It just crushes me that they can't sit down and come to an agreement, because regardless whether Cowboys, you know, help that gym be profitable or not on a balance sheet or an income statement, he damn sure has helped build some of the fighters that have been there that have. Right, whether he's training with them, he's teaching them, certainly helped me while I was training. So it's hard to see a guy who I consider like a brother, and then my coach, you know, Greg and Wink was really, you know, my main guy. I hate seeing that divorce there, because, and I want to take both sides. I wish I could get them on a table and get them to come to an agreement, because they have both contributed so much to that team. And it does sting to see, you know, Cowboy not chosen over another athlete to coach, you know, when he's getting ready to fight. That's wild.
Right. And I'd imagine you would not be one of those lining up to see Cowboy Cerrone and Diego Sanchez settle this inside the octagon, right, at this stage
Hell
of their
no.
respective
no,
careers,
no way.
You know?
Right. And if I were still training there, this conversation would have happened around a round table like this before it ever hit the media, and we would have tried to solve it that way. It's the same way that a Joey Villasenor or Keith Jardine, when they were leading that gym, would have done it. But, you know, it's tough. It's a tough, tough situation.
Brian Stan with us on the Anakin Florian podcast. One thing that is missed in the lead up to Khabib and Conor is your analysis, so I want to get a little bit of it here. I think there are so many angles at which you can attack this thing, right? But among them, I mean, what are you most interested to see in what at least on paper looks to a lot of people like a classic striker versus grappler confrontation?
It does, and I would say that it goes a little beyond that in terms of, you know, conditioning. The conditioning is going to be a big factor of this contest as well. And not just, you know, everybody knows that in the first two rounds is when Conor's going to be the most dangerous to beat Khabib. And we saw Khabib very susceptible to straight left hands when he fought Michael Johnson. He ate a number of them. He doesn't move his head real well. How fast will Khabib want to close the distance and get in on Conor's legs? And if he chooses that route, how well will Conor maintain his energy? Because we know, if anything tires Conor out, it's wrestling. And he comes in great condition, but just because of the way he's built as an athlete, he's not a guy who's going to be conditioned to where he can wrestle for five straight rounds. He's just not going to be able to. He's got to keep his distance. He's got to land big left hands. He's got to hurt Khabib early, but he's got to be smart about how he expends his energy. And he does have the power to knock Khabib out. We've seen Khabib get rocked. He's a human being. For Khabib, you know, for me, he needs to move his head, and he doesn't need to go in there and try and prove that he can strike with Conor. He needs to use his bread and butter. He needs to be able to get him down. what I'm watching for, when I've seen Khabib grapple, in my eyes, he is the best at controlling someone on the ground with one hand and being able to punch almost continuously with the other hand. That is so hard to do. When you're grappling with good guys at this level, the championship level, you got to use two hands to control them. And Conor can grapple. People forget. Right. The kid can grapple, and he's good on the ground. He's a big, strong guy. Can Khabib control him with one arm and land sufficient shots with the other arm before a referee wants to stand him up? Because if I'm Conor and I want to manage my energy, if I do get taken down early, I want to tie Khabib up. I want to make it boring and force them to stand me back up rather than expend the energy myself to have to wall walk and work my way back up. I don't want to have to do that because it will reduce my punching power over time. Michael Bisping used to employ a great strategy where he would shoot takedowns on guys. Even if he didn't land them, he would force you to defend them, and he would steal your punching power. He did it to me. He did it to Vanderlei. He did it in a lot of his fights where he would make you wrestle, and he would use his pace as a weapon to slow you down in the later rounds and take away your punching power, because for him, he could punch the same power for all of those rounds. You know, Khabib has got to be smart, close the distance, get this kid down and wear him out over the first two rounds, and then, you know, look to be dominant in the third, fourth, and fifth. For Conor, I want to see, you know, can he land the big left? Can he move and avoid the takedown early? And then can he manage his energy efficiently so he doesn't fade in the later rounds if he can't knock this kid out in the first two?
Right. So if someone's giving you $1,000 to bet on one side of this, Khabib's the favorite right now, about minus 170. Conor McGregor holding at plus 140. Do you have a lean here 12 days out?
I do. I'm leaning versus Khabib. And you know, forget all the things I said. This game is very much about mentality. And I have not been around either fighter for some time, so I have no idea where they are, but I'm going to make my best educated guess. When you've made north of $100 million, your level of hunger, the level you're willing to go to suffer to win a fight is different than a kid who's maybe got 50 grand in the bank from Dagestan. Khabib may have more money than that in the bank, but that's a different level, man. This kid comes from a place. It's different, but similar to the place that Conor came from, too. Conor came from a hard upbringing. It wasn't easy, right? He was trying to be a plumber and couldn't make it as such. Came from a blue-collar family, and he was hungry. That's where Khabib is now. And he's going to be more primal. I think he's going to be willing to go to a certain depth of exhaustion and pain to win this fight. And Conor is tough as they come as well. I don't know if he's willing to go that far now, having lived so comfortably for the last year. Hunger is a big part of these big fights, and I give the advantage to Khabib there. And I think that he's able to out-wrestle Conor early, wear him down, and as Conor begins to fade a little bit, he doesn't fade much, but we saw it a little bit in the Nate Diaz fights, Khabib takes over there.
And it sounds like you don't at all worry about the big fight atmosphere for Khabib Nurmagomedov. If anything, it sounds like you think he might be buoyed by it, or I just think this is a different walk than he will have ever experienced prior.
And you make a phenomenal point. And the one thing, I said this to somebody this weekend, you know, I said, look, on paper and as I analyze the fight, I think that Khabib wins this fight, but I can never count out Conor when the lights shine brightest. The kid just shows up. He just shows up. But I can't forget that first Nate Diaz fight.
Yeah.
I can't forget. You know, he is a human being. The kid is human. And this is a guy in Khabib Nurmagomedov that, in my eyes, some of the things that hurt him against Nate Diaz, Khabib is a little better at.
Right. Very interesting stuff, Brian Stann. Great stuff. Continued success, my friend. Thanks for hopping on with us. Happy birthday.
Anytime, brother.
Hope you can break some bread with I miss you too, man. And hey, if you ever want to call live sporting events, you know, we'll leave the light on for you, right? Motel 6. Get back in the saddle.
Awesome. My pleasure.
All right. Thank you, buddy. There he is. Former UFC commentator, UFC veteran Brian Stann with us here on the Anakin Florian podcast. That's a good egg right there. Seems like some of the early experts and ex-fighters that I'm talking to are leaning Khabib Nurmagomedov. So we're going to see how many expert picks we can get between now and fight night. But, you know, Longo and Stann are both going that way. I think Kenny's going to come on here and pick Conor McGregor 1 week from today if he shows up for the podcast. Just kidding, Flo, I love you. But realistically, I think Kenny's going to step on these airwaves a week from now, and he is going to pick Conor McGregor to win the fight. We'll see how it plays out. But we got to get out of here for this week, ladies. Thank you to our guests, Chuck Mendenhall, Ray Longo, Jimmy Smith, Brian Stann. Thank you to Ben Wasorek, the crew behind the glass at Fox Sports. So next week, do you believe it will be fight week? already, UFC 229, Khabib versus McGregor. So we'll preview the big one, and that podcast is coming your way Monday, October 1st. Until then, appreciate you all listening. We'll talk to you in less than a week. Don't text and drive. You'll later.
The John Anik and Kenny Florian Podcast.
Sports betting is sweeping across the country faster than the coronavirus, and Wagering Week is your antidote. I'm Tom Martin, and I'm a veteran sports analyst and respected sports handicapper who helped build ESPN's brand. I've been recognized and awarded by Pro Football Weekly and Gaming Today magazine as the honest handicapper. Let the other guys give you the same old boring sports talk with the same tired storylines. We'll give it to you straight here every Friday on Wagering Week. Don't gamble with other podcasts. Let Sports Garden Network's Wagering Week help your bottom line.